Welcome to another episode of Write You a Song. I'm Tom Maley, and this podcast features some of the biggest names in country music songwriting. If this is your first listen, go back through the archives and check out conversations with Josh Osborne, Shane McAnally, Ashley McBride, Brett James, Jeffrey Steele, Liz Rose, and a whole bunch of others. Now, if you like the podcast, give it a quick review and share it. And if you don't, keep that to yourself. Now, on with the show. If songwriting, as Dave Grohl once put it, is about extending a hand to the listener, then every country music fan the past two decades has shaken hands with this month's guest on Write You a Song. He's written huge hits for everybody from Eric Church to Reba to George Strait, including the top country song of 1999, which was also one of the biggest love songs of all time. There's a reason I say it that way. You'll find out as Write You a Song goes on. Marv Green, thank you for joining us today on Write You a Song.
Well, my pleasure. Good to be here.
And we're recording this out in California. The podcast originates at KNCI Radio in Sacramento. And you are a California native.
I am. Born and raised in Santa Barbara. Well, born in Santa Barbara, raised in Santa Barbara County up in the Santa Ynez Valley, right above Santa Barbara. And, still call it my home.
Now, we talked several podcasts back with another California native, Jeffrey Steele. And he grew up in kind of the L.A. area and was initially kind of into the rock and roll scene there. But from what I understand, you were steeped in country music from pretty early on, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was exposed to it. Just my dad and my grandparents were listening to it all the time. My brother and I just sort of naturally were gravitated towards that as we started to learn how to play guitar. Those are the songs that we began singing early on, in addition to, you know, artists like John Denver wanted to learn those kind of songs, James Taylor kind of songs as well.
Is that because those were the kind of songs that at that time got the ladies?
This was so early on, I don't know how important the ladies were, but but they became very important as time.
And I'm sure just a product of your generation, you were probably exposed to all kinds of music.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. And, you know, when high school started, I was a big Tom Petty fan. And, unfortunately for me, there was a lot of, some of the 80s stuff, good, the bad, the ugly, as far as that kind of music. I was first and foremost a guitar player, but I certainly, you know, gravitated and got pulled into some of what sounded new at the time, and which is rather strange for a guitar player. But I definitely got interested in some other electronic music too, but always came back to acoustic based or, you know, at least traditional kind of music.
Was your family musical?
Well, my dad had picked up a guitar. I've seen pictures, you know, and as far as, you know, when I was around him, or even to this day when I'm around him, he likes to think he can sing. You know, it's funny. He loves some good old, Hank Sr. and some Lefty Frizzell sort of stuff. But it's funny. He never really pursued it at all. The one who actually got my brother's attention and my attention was my uncle. At barbecues and family get-togethers, he would break out this late 20s Martin 018, which I have. He actually handed it down to me, and really cool guitar. But that was the first, you know, sign of anybody just showing us, hey, here's a guitar. And it just really it was very interesting, and it turned into one of those things where we're like, you know, that's, you know, my uncle was an influence. And again, well, you know, little things. Hee-haw. I mean, Hee-haw used to come on every Saturday night, and for, you know, there was limited TV programming where I was or at that time, and it was a big deal on Saturday night to watch Hee-haw, as, you know, funny as that may sound. But, I mean, you know, just, you got another moment to see, you know, Buck Owens or Johnny Cash or Kris Kristofferson sing for a minute, and it was, you know, an influence as well.
What about music sunk its hooks into you? Was it seeing your uncle having so much fun and people enjoying his playing that kind of gave you that first idea that, hey, this is fun? Or was there something deeper than that, something kind of more innate to your, I don't know, DNA?
Yeah, I would say more innate to DNA. I think for whatever reason, the fact that you could sing and play and take your emotions somewhere and just kind of pour it into something, I think that's part of it. Maybe on my mom's side, the Italians, you know, they used to sit around the piano and sing. From what I understand, I never saw it, but maybe some of that's in my DNA. I feel like it's just something spiritually that was inside. I mean, and that goes for the music itself and the song itself, because I remember early on and being 16 years old and going to a car wash and listening to Casey Kasem and just going, yeah, the artists are cool, but I'm always attracted to the song itself. And I don't even know why, you know, it just was.
So you were attracted to, was it more the lyrics or the melody, the hookiness of a song that drew? Because like when I was, we're probably about the same age. And, you know, when I, in 1984, 85, yeah, I wanted to be David Lee Roth, except I wasn't good looking and couldn't sing or anything else. But, you know, I think most young guys, they want to be, you know, the lead singer. But here you are going beneath the surface and really kind of paying attention to the actual music.
Yeah, and I think a part of me is kind of likes to be public and on a stage, and a part of me doesn't like to be, and maybe that had some influence on the fact that I love the craft of songwriting. But don't get me wrong. I mean, I had moments where I wanted to be, you know, Jackson Browne or Tom Petty or one of those guys and be on a stage. For whatever reason, it always, for me, it always came back to wanting to write, and then just, you know, first and foremost the song, and wanted to do it a lot, you know, not just wanting to have a short list, but wanting to keep writing all the time, which is interesting, you know.
Do you remember the first song where you really paid attention to the lyrics?
I mean, I would probably say way back in the you know, a California kid like myself, I mean, I remember my brother buying Merle Haggard, one of the first live records he did, and then one of the first country records I purchased was the Honky Tonk Heroes album that Waylon Jennings did. And I was really, you know, those lyrics really, for whatever reason, I mean, I don't know, it felt like some, you know, the outlaw movement was, I wasn't aware of what that was, but the songs felt like outlaws, literally, and that sort of attracted me. And I also paid attention to what John Denver, because he was an artist where you could have an acoustic guitar and figure the songs out. And, you know, groups like the Beatles, just because of my age, I mean, I actually discovered them later, you know, and the Rolling Stones, you know. You know, for me, the new music of the Stones was like Miss You and that whole era of the Stones, you know, Tattoo You and that mm-hmm. part. So those songs were new to me then. And then I went backwards and you know, discovered some of the older stuff. So
I love the story about in high school, you were already writing songs. It sounds like you had a composition teacher. And rather than write essays, what did they have you do?
Oh, yeah. So his name was Mr. Black, Sherman Black. And he, I approached him. It was a composition class in high school. And I just said, Mr. Black, is there any way instead of writing compositions, you'd let me write lyrics? And he said, yeah, as long as I see you're doing your work and whatnot. And I actually have an envelope somewhere with some of those. I need to find out where I put it, but it's really cool. He would comment on them and just go, I really get this one, or I don't get this one. Or so what a great, great teacher to even let me do it first and foremost. And what a great, you know, a great way to sort of work on your craft, you know.
Did you have melodies to those lyrics at that time? Were these actual songs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I feel bad because I go back, and he always – wanted me to participate. He was the English teacher, but he's also a drama teacher, and he asked me so many times. I really could use someone who could sing and play for this play, and I just ran from that stuff. You know, it's just I wasn't going to do that, which is a bummer. It would have been another great opportunity, but he kept asking me. I got up towards the end, and I sang one for him. But all of them had melodies in my I was even before the four tracks. I was recording them on a little tape recorder.
There was another teacher in your life who you give credit for actually getting you off your butt and getting out of California and going to Nashville.
Oh, yeah. And again, it took me a few years to let that resonate. But, I just remember, his name was Harry Bulow. I don't know where he is now. But he was at Santa Barbara City. I started to take music major courses there. And a super, super talented saxophone player, just amazing sax player, really. And these classes with him were more jazz. He didn't have a whole lot of guitar knowledge, but he said, yeah, you can play guitar in the jazz ensemble. And so I was trying to figure out Charlie Parker licks and cool other jazz players, sax licks. And one afternoon, I stayed a little late. It was just me. And he knew I was doing, a few little acoustic gigs around Santa Barbara and then playing country with my brother. And I think by then I actually had broken up my pop kind of rock. Well, it was more of a pop band. But anyway, so hanging out in class, and he just basically sat down with me and he said, Green, he goes, what do you really want to do with your life? And I said, well, first and foremost, I want to be a songwriter. Something that makes most sense to me. And he said, well, if you stay here, you're going to become a music teacher. And I was like, I don't really want to do that. So anyway, he basically said, just go to L.A. or go to New York or go to Nashville if that's what calls to you. But, you could always come back and do this. But go chase it. So that was good. And like I said, it still took a couple years to heed his advice.
You're growing up in a small town. To make that leap from, that's all you've ever known to either L.A. or to Nashville, how did you do it?
Just classic, a guitar and a suitcase. I didn't have a lot, but what I had, I just sold, gave away, and just hopped on a plane. I had one friend here, Junie Fisher, and she let me crash on her couch, and I did what I had to do. I waited tables, answered phones for JCPenney catalog when that was a gig, and just sort of hit the streets and played all the open mic writer shows that I could. I do have to say, for me, one great thing that happened is out in California, I met a radio DJ named Tom Kafuri. Tom did tell me, if you ever do make it to Nashville, I do know someone back there. He said my wife is second cousin to someone, and so I just kind of filed that away. And so I was here, moved here, finally got my own apartment after a few weeks, and but all the while recording the song, new songs I was writing while I was here. And so then I called Tom back and I said, now who do you know back here? And he said, well, my wife's second cousin is a guy named Scott Hendricks. And I was a fan of, obviously reading the producers and writers on all the records back when you had physical product to actually look at. And I said, well, of course I know who Scott is. And so said, is there any way I could take him a six-song demo tape that I've made here in Nashville? And he called, and Scott said he was really busy producing, but just to drop it by. Unbeknownst to me, Scott was just starting a new little publishing company with Warner Music, and he was looking for a developing writer, a new person. And that's when my cassette tape demos hit his desk.
Wow! And did he give it a? Was it like did he call you right back, or did you have to wait months and just sit there wringing your hands?
Well, Tom warned me. He said he's real busy. You know, it could be a month or, you know, or longer just because he's in the middle of a couple records. And I said, all right, well, thanks for at least, you know, making the connection. And I brought it over there. And then the next Monday, like 3 days, that was like on a Friday. And then the Monday I got a call from Scott and he said, man, I'd love to meet with you and talk to you about what you're all about. He goes, these songs are really promising. And so, yeah, it was a quick turnaround. I mean, I'd only been in town about 5.5 months.
How confident were you in your ability when you went there?
Oh, I felt like I could do it. I mean, I felt like I did have to immerse myself in a place like Nashville. And the good news is that I came out about 2 months before I moved here and just kind of went to the Bluebird and Douglas Corner and some of these songwriters clubs. And I just saw a place where I felt like, you know, I can do this. I can be here with just a guitar and write these songs and make it happen. So, you know, I obviously had some confidence. Otherwise, I wouldn't have left the beautiful Santa Barbara. You know, I love the ocean. I love the mountains. And but I was confident enough to know I could do it, but I also felt like I had to do it. I would regret it if I didn't try.
You never had any plan B, did you?
There was no plan B. But, you know, it's interesting because plan B was sort of planted in my head for the longest time. And I felt like, you know, oh, plan B, you know. But I think once I turned 25, I completely exploded any possibility for plan B. I figure, you know, got a window and, you know, no plan B. Plan B is plan A. You know?
and your first number one was a hit for George Strait.
Correct.
That's
got to
be
called True. Sorry.
And that's got to be heady for a young, even a confident young songwriter to have your first number one go to one of the legends, living legends in country music. And he takes it all the way to the top of the charts. How surreal was that?
Yeah, I was just getting ready to say it was completely surreal because maybe the year before I had a top 10, a new artist on Curb called David Kirsch. Mm-hmm. But then to have George come along and record one of my songs and then take it to number one began about 4 years in a row of surrealism. I mean, I just my career just at that point just took off. And it's definitely pinch yourself kind of moments. Because George is a great example of one of the ones that, you know, was certainly hoping and praying for, but it just seemed like, you know, the odds were against me, obviously.
Did you write True with George in mind, or was that just a song that you wrote one day and you sent it off to, you know, for whoever to record?
Well, now, going down to Warner Chappell Music, which is Warner's publishing portion. So I'd report there every morning. I was mixing and mingling and writing with some of the writers who would, you know, give a new writer a chance there. And I met a guy named Jeff Stevens. Jeff had some success with some like Alabama, and he had a good little run. And I had most of the chorus to True in my head and written down. And honestly, I was thinking it'd be a really good song for Ronnie and Kix, Brooks and Dunn, to do. And so we even demoed it that way. I felt like it was a good shot at Brooks and Dunn. And then Michael Knox, who was my main publisher or one of my main guys there, he said, we should bring this over to Tony Brown for George Strait. And you know, it was one of those things where, to his credit, he was sort of thinking, well, where's George Strait going to go, you know, musically or whatever. So, and Tony loved it, played it for George, and George loved it. So I was not thinking George Strait when I wrote it, though, to answer your question.
True, in this modern world, when two lovers get together, chances of them ever making it to forever couldn't be better than two in a million hearts. Girl, this ain't just another run-of-the-mill emotion. What I'm feeling is a definition of devotion. My love for you is true. The sun coming up each morning, bright as the light in a baby's smile, sure as a mountain, river, a wild.
song that was the 2000 BMI Song of the Year. It got you the BMI Songwriter of the Year Award in 2001. And the song is still just synonymous with weddings. And that's Amazed from Lone Star. Where did the impetus for that song come from?
Yeah, so this is 1998. I just met my wife, and Amy Mayo, Chris Lindsay, my co-writers, were falling in love with each other. And Amy, you know, it's funny because Amy and I kind of landed in Nashville around the same time, and so we'd hang out and go listen to other songwriters and just talk about music, and went to, you know, go to some parties and just play each other what we were up to. And she recognized in a sisterly way when I met Tasha that Tasha kind of had my number. And so she called me, and, you know, she'd kind of just egg me on as a sister would. And she called me one night, and I don't know, she was completely serious but also having fun with me. And she's from Gaston, Alabama. And so in this Alabama kind of voice, she said, "Marv, what are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just, you know, back at my apartment now." And she goes, "Well, tonight I want to write a love song." And she was laughing. And I was like, "Oh, you do, do you?" And she said, "Yeah, why don't you come over?" And I said, "All right, I'll come over." And so we just, you know, we were fascinated by Pablo Neruda and some of these Rumi kind of poems, and I loved, you know, kind of going that direction, you know, with a lyric and just thinking about, you know, the fact that we were all falling in love, and that song happened.
Every time our eyes meet, this feeling inside me is almost more than I can take. Baby, when you touch me, I can feel how much you love me, and it just blows me away. I've never been this close to anyone or anything. I can hear your thoughts, I can see your dreams. I don't know how you do what you do. I'm so in love with you. It just keeps getting better. I want to spend the rest of my life with you by my side, forever and ever. Every little thing that you do, baby, I'm amazed.
Do you carry ideas around, you know, like on your phone or on a notepad, or do you just kind of let the magic happen when you're in the room?
Well, I'm always putting stuff in, you know, we've got these iPhones now. So whether I'm recording a little piece of a melody or just writing down a title or a phrase, you know, my iPhone is my companion for recording snippets of stuff. And then, you know, I like to just kind of walk around and see. I love, you know, when phrases and melodies kind of appear together. Mm-hmm. You know, people always talk about, you know, can I put my poem to music? And I'm like, well, you can. You're going to probably edit something because, you know, words have sort of phrasing and inspire melodies. So it's one of those things that I like to give the line a chance to have a melody when you say it, you know?
Words inspire melody. I love the way you said that.
Well, they do, yeah. Because especially if you're talking about phrases, you know, you start, you speak in a way to where you're saying a phrase, and it kind of, if you just let it, it can totally inspire a melody. And that's why I like it when they come together. I'm fascinated by, you know, some of those collaborators like Bernie and Elton John and Bernie, because, you know, I mean, I don't know that relationship, but I feel like Bernie wrote those lyrics and then, you know, knew Elton well enough to figure out that he would find the melodies.
Do you have a word melody combination that is one of your favorites that you came up with that you just personally? I mean, I have loved from the very first time I heard it, the melody of True. I just, it sounded so different at the time. And to me, it still does.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. And that was for me. I love a good one word title. And so for me, what was happening there is trying, you know, looking at the word true, following it with a phrase that basically, you know, you're playing with the word true and writing a love song, obviously. But the way those phrases fell out just felt right, you know. And that's one. Shotgun Rider, I would say, is one where I like how that fits.
I don't ever want to wake up looking into someone else's eyes. Another voice calling me baby on the other end of the phone. A new girl putting on her makeup before dinner on Friday night. No, I don't ever want to know. No other Shotgun Rider beside me singing to the radio.
Shotgun Rider has an interesting story behind it in that, and your friend JT Harding texted me this to ask you, that wasn't the first song that Tim McGraw did called Shotgun Rider.
No, no. And I remember it happening once before with George Strait, where, not with me, but he recorded a song he put on the album called She'll Leave You With a Smile. And then several albums later, he had the same title but completely different song. And I was thinking, wow, that's amazing. Why didn't they kind of get together and just kind of slightly change the other title, just at least for nothing else, just not to confuse people? So then fast forward, I should have known Tim had a song called Shotgun Rider. I think I had an album cut on the same album where he's got the first Shotgun Rider. But anyway, I write this song with Hillary Lindsay and Troy Burgess, and it's called Shotgun Rider. And that's one of those songs we completely wrote into. We didn't know it was going to be called Shotgun Rider until we got into the chorus and started going. And I like to write that way. I don't have to know exactly what it's called, you know, until we write it. So, but anyway, so where you're getting at, so we're done. I know Tim's recorded the song. And as we can, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm going to go out on the, you know, YouTube and see if he's playing it live yet, because I knew he'd recorded it. So I do the title, and Shotgun Rider pops up. I didn't listen to it yet, but I'm like, oh, my gosh, look at here. We got Shotgun Rider and Faith Hill singing on it. So I get really excited until I hit play, and I'm like, wait a minute. This is not our Shotgun Rider. Tim already has a Shotgun Rider.
She said, love me, oh, man. Where are you going? Don't you know that the life of a cowboy is no good alone? If you tear down that fence of rusty barbed wire, then I'll lay down beside you and be your Shotgun Rider.
But then Tim and Faith did do one of your songs.
They did. They did a song called Let's Make Love, yeah, which was beautifully done by Faith on the Breathe album. And then Tim actually put it on the Greatest Hits album. So, yeah, that was a good one.
Baby, I've been drifting away and dreaming all day. I'm holding you, touching you. The only thing I wanna do is be with you, as close to you as I can be. Let's make love all night. Until the sun comes up.
Another song of yours that I think has a really interesting melody and just the way the word structure, lyric structure goes is Carrie Underwood's Wasted. That is another song that doesn't, when it came out, it didn't sound like anything else on the radio.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I love that. And again, that was an idea about, you know, I love how Wasted could be used in a couple of different ways. I always wanted to talk about and have a song about, you know, just sort of how I felt before I moved to Nashville, because I was definitely in that frame of mind. If I don't do something, I feel like I'm wasting something. So that was sort of where I was pointing that. And to Hillary Lindsay's credit, she started talking about this girl in the first verse, and I was like, oh, okay, I like where that's going.
Standing at the back door, she tried to make it fast. Once you hit the hardwood, it fell like broken glass. She said, sometimes love slips away, and you just can't get it back. Let's face it. For one split second, she almost turned around, but that would be like pouring raindrops back into a cloud. So she took another step, said, I see the way out, and I'm gonna take it.
When you come up with a song like that is a bit different, do you know right away that it's a bit different? And if you do, does it concern you at all? Or are you excited by having something that sounds unlike anything else?
Oh, yeah, I'm all excited about it. And it's, you know, I've been around here long enough to kind of see, you know, the circles of how things kind of come around and disappear and come back. But yeah, I'm always trying to at least, you know, try to find something that's, you know, hadn't been done or hadn't been done in a while, just to, you know, kind of give the listener something new. That's definitely something that we're always trying to chase.
And in that regard, I think the epitome of a song that sounded like nothing else on the radio when it came out and still doesn't, it's one of my favorite songs, and that's Eric Church's Creepin'. That song is just a trip from start to finish. When you conceived of that song, when you got it written, did the final product match the way that you dreamt it up in your head?
No. So I wrote that with, it's just Eric and I, and we wrote it down on Music Row's early in the I think in the writing of that Chief record, and when we, you know, it was Eric's idea, we sat there in the room and just played it on two acoustic guitars. I thought when we were done, I thought we had this kind of acoustic-y, Appalachian-y, kind of spooky song, but and I thought it was cool, but that's all I knew of that song. The couple guys on acoustic guitars, and we did do a bom, bom, bom. We did that together, but a little tribute to David Bowie, if you will, or David Essex even. But so I don't hear nothing about it. And then Catherine, Eric's wife, calls, you know, a few months down the road, and she said, oh, they're in the studio with Creepin' right now. Wait until you hear this. And in my mind, I'm like, well, okay. I wonder what, you know, did they go grassy with it? Did they, you know, and knowing full well that Jay Joyce and Eric, when they get together, anything can happen. And then when I heard that thing, I was just blown away. It was just such a record and such a greatly produced thing. But, yeah, I'd like to play you the original work tape for that song. It's stripped down with a couple acoustics.
Like a honeybee beating on my screen door, I got a little buzz in my head, so from my bed I can feel the sun roll around here. The morning comes, just a creeping, 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 creeping. You shot out of here like a bullet from a gun, a flip of a switch, a thief on the run. Since the day you left me, baby,
All right, so just a couple more questions, then I'll let you go. You've been more than kind. This podcast is listened to by folks who are thinking about becoming songwriters. What is one or two key pieces of advice that you would give them?
I really feel as long as you can be honest with yourself and feel you are ready, you've got to be in a music center. I mean, if you're not in Nashville and if you're not in, it depends what kind of music you're doing, of course. But if you're writing country songs, or it's not just country anymore, but if you feel like you're at that point, you really got to be here. The thought of shipping something off or sending something off or even emailing with no FaceTime is just, I don't think it's reality. I think you benefit so much more from being where it all happens. Personally, I believe a little bit about energy and the energy of this town or whatever town you pick. So I think when you need to be ready. You need to ask yourself. You need to listen to the songs you're hearing on records and on the radio and go, can I stand up to these? Can I break through whatever it is? And then read, you know, and you know, you've got to have a lot of information coming in for information to come out. So read, listen, watch movies and stuff. I say this and I'm like going, I need to do more myself. I'm a better writer when I'm reading. When I'm in the middle of a book, I'm a better writer, you know.
That was one of the questions I wanted to ask. How do you feel you're well?
Yeah, a good novel, a movie, a new album can do it. But
do you listen to other music, other songs?
Oh, yeah, just kind of see what's new in all genres, see what people are liking. And there's always the artists you already know. You're always, you know, I still like to listen to see what they're doing. Yeah, because, you know, the good thing about songs is that, you know, I'll listen. And the good news for me is a lot of times they're buddies of mine. And I'll, you know, it's that song where you get the turn of phrase and you're like, ah, I can't believe I haven't thought of that. You know, and you call them and you're like, dang it, Al, man, that's a good one. You know, I just gave this example to a friend of mine because they were asking me a similar question. And I said, well, here's the deal. I don't know what you have. Yes, I'm happy to spend 30 minutes and listen to what you have. But what interests me is when you get like Josh Osborne and Shane, who I know you've already interviewed. You know, if you got a title or an idea that says, are we written in the sand? Or are we written in the stars? You know, that kind of stuff is just like, you know, just a phrase. It just gets me interested. And then you're off and running, you know.
Are we just a backseat trying to get it while we can? Are we names in a tattoo or just a number on a hand? Are we last caught kissing or will we be reminiscing with each other for the next 40 years? Are we written in the stars, baby, or are we written in the sand?
All right, and we'll wrap it up. Your friend JT Harding, who has been on a previous podcast and who also hooked me up with you today, he sent me an email and he wanted me to run a few of these things by you. So I'll just I'll read you what he wrote and then you comment. The first one is really coincidental because as we're recording this today, it's Taylor Swift's 30th birthday. He says, you were one of the first people to write with Taylor and you still get invited to her birthday parties?
Well, yeah, I don't know about still every birthday party, but what I will say for Taylor is, although I've never had any success with Taylor, although I did write with her a little during when she was making that first record, she, no matter, you know, she's super mega superstar, she still somehow, you know, wants to, you know, every now and then reach out and let me know that she, you know, she remembers. So yeah, that's you know, just as busy as she is, and I've gotten to know her folks, too, and she's just a, you know, great person underneath all the super shiny stuff.
JT says, Marv loves guitars so much, he named his son?
Gibson! Yeah, I mean, you know, and you can't argue with the sound of Gibson Green anyways. But yeah, I love Gibsons and Martins, and I do my Telecaster, my Fender. I love guitars, and every guitar's got a, you know, song, guitars have different songs in them, so you got to have a couple different ones.
All right, and the last thing from JT, and this sounds like it might be a bit of a point of contention between the two of you. He says, Marv, your George Strait song sings, "It Comes Natural." Isn't the proper way to say it, "It Comes Naturally"?
That's funny, because that was actually a debate. I wrote that song with Jim Collins, and we got to that point of the song, and he's the one, he's from Texas, and he's saying, "It just comes natural," and I was like, "You mean it just comes naturally?" He goes, "Oh, no, George," because we were actually thinking about all that, and he said, "No, it needs to be, it just comes natural." And I said, "Well, I don't know if that's completely correct, but it sounds good, so let's go with it." And it worked out just fine.
Sun shines, clouds rain, train whistles blow, and guitars play. Preachers preach, farmers plow. Wishes go up and the world goes round. And I love you. It just comes natural. It just comes natural.
Man, Marv Green, thank you so much for taking time and passing along some of your experience and wisdom.
Well, yeah, it just flew by. And anytime, I'm happy to talk, you know.
Dawn breaks, cowboys riding town.
And that is a wrap for another episode of Write You a Song. Thank you again to Marv Green, who, by the way, puts on a charity event every year in Solvang, California, that features himself and other top songwriter friends. Might be a cool road trip to make later this summer. You can find out more at NashvilleNights.org. Write You a Song is a production of Bonneville Communications and recorded at KNCI Radio Studios in Sacramento, California. Again, give us a like and share it if you're so inclined. Next month, another writer whose work you might be familiar with. Thrasher, next time on Write You a Song.
Let your hair down, get you some of this laid on back, kick your shoes off. Let your hair down, get you some of this laid on back, kick your shoes off.